Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I'm your co-host, John Bruford, joined by my co-host, Fintan F. Costello. Hello, Fintan.
Hello, John.
Fintan, I don't feel very well this week. So you're going to have to be the vivacious, bubbly one.
That I can do. I am full of vim and vigor, as they say. On this week's episode, we've got an absolute cracker for you. We have Sarah, and Sarah from Gambling Integrity.
You can say her surname.
I need such a mental run-up to say her surname, and I know it's really easy to say.
It is.
But I'm just, it triggers my dyslexia. And I'm can you say it?
Ramanauskas.
There we go. You say it so well. You're such a
wild horse. Say it?
Ramanauskas.
It's just because you had an example.
It's exactly it, mate. I've never had an original idea in my life. All I do is copy things. Fun fact. So we had Sarah Ramanauskas from Gambling Integrity. Sorry, Sarah, for the whole name thing. It must be so embarrassing at this point. Embarrassing for us.
She's probably just bored of it by now. I mean, it's like being called Bruford. Fuck.
Well, it's how I met my wife, actually. So her name's Jane, and I didn't make a Tarzan joke was my whole fucking chat-up line. And that just worked. It was the only bloke ever, I think, who didn't make the Tarzan joke.
Oh, man, I've got such a story that I could share now, but I better not, because it involves a very nice lady and... So years ago, right, I was in this pub with a mate, and he was chatting to this lady, and her friend was just absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. Just beautiful blue eyes, really elegant looking woman. 100% not the kind of woman that would go for me ever. And I said to my friend, would you introduce me? He's like, of course, absolutely. She's lovely. So we're sitting chatting away and we're getting on like a house on fire. And I'm thinking, wow. And she says, you know, you're the first man I've spoken to in I don't know how many years that hasn't just talked to my chest. And I thought, what's she talking about? What? So I just like laughed it off, you know. That's because I was busy looking at your ass, that kind of thing. But as we got to know each other better over time, no, I can't share it. I'm really sorry. I can't do it. I can't go there. It's too risque, even for me and my complete lack of filters.
What a cliffhanger.
I just can't do it. But mate, you can DM me on LinkedIn.
This is how we get subscribers, right? You gotta if we get another 500 subscribers, we'll release the full story. There we go.
But that does remind me, though, actually, we do chat with Sarah, and she is as tremendous as she usually is. You know, she brings such an incisive intelligence to any conversation. So always a real pleasure to talk to her. But that reminds me, in no way at all, that I just accidentally bought a bike.
Ooh, what bike did you get, John?
Well, it's nothing really sexy. I mean, it's really sexy for me, but it's not, you know, you get these blokes and they got these like full carbon bikes and all that. It's nothing like that. It's an aluminium frame. It's a lovely bike. But I just kind of said to the bike shop, what are the colorways they're looking at for next year for this? Because I'm a little bit interested. That was when I had some money in the bank. And they took my register of interest. And they know me well because I used to be their next door neighbor. I got an email Monday saying your bike's arrived.
Smart. Like,
but the I ordered a bike. Closed. I ordered a bike like 4 years ago or 5 years ago maybe. And it never arrived. And there were for lots of different issues. So we ended up like just canceling it. And I really wish I hadn't because it was basically my dream bike. And so I'm like, what, that sort of blue and orange one? And they're like, no, the new one. Oh, shit. So that just leads me neatly into, if anybody would like to advertise or sponsor the Gambling Files, think of it as help John pay for a bike he can't afford project.
Could they put their logo on your bike?
They definitely can. And it is in no way a tax write-off.
There we go. All right, so let's buy John a bike. I think that's the message there.
If you take nothing else from this episode, take that.
Take that. brilliant. I need photos of the bike.
It's a nice bike.
I love a new bike day. It's very exciting. So anyway, so Sarah from Gambling Integrity.
Yep.
We brought Sarah on to talk about, we talked about a lot of things. So the key topic, we said, hey, Sarah, this NHS thing's a car crash. Can you come in and talk about it? So this is where it was announced the other day or mid last week or something that the NHS are not going to take funding from, I want to say GambleAware. Is it GambleAware or GamCare? I always get them mixed up.
I think it's GambleAware.
Yeah, one of those, because it's industry funded and various reasons. And Sarah gives a very nuanced and very good understanding of what's going on there. And then since we had Sarah on the line, we kind of just took full advantage of our knowledge. So we also talked about the Flutter this week as part of their quarterly or part of their earnings announcements, talked about getting 75% of their user base using at least one responsible gambling tool by 2030, which to me just feels like why isn't it 100% and why isn't it tomorrow kind of thing. And you know, Sarah had a lot of really good points.
She puts you right in your place.
Look, it's clearly I'm an idiot and I'm here to learn. So she was a very good conversation about that.
Would like to just chip in and just say that the sound quality in the conversation with Sarah, we had to use a different way to record it. So it might not be up to what we usually use. So sorry if it doesn't sound awesome.
And then there was a bunch of other things that cropped up and we just had a good chat with Sarah and it was all she's super smart and very patient with us idiots. So that was quite nice.
Seriously.
And very, you know, very generous of her, I think is the best way to describe it. And then our second guest, he had a completely different way of pronouncing his surname, which
I'm not even going to go there.
I've gone blank. Hang on a second.
It definitely happened.
No, we definitely had him.
Do you want me to tell you who it was?
It was, no, I know who it was. I just got stuck in a surname. So we had Matt Zarb, cousin, director of Clean Up Gambling, and he also one of the founders of the Gamban app. He's also incredibly well known for his Guardian and Daily Mail articles. And we wanted to bring Matt on to have a chat and get to know him and understand more about his thinking and his
surname, right? His surname. I was thinking about this because there's a famous French film, and it was remade in America. The remake was called Cousins, and the French was called Cousin Cousine. So it's Matt Zarb Cousine, which I'm sure is the feminine form of cousin.
No. When did you do French?
I did it at school.
How long ago was that?
Well,
you're just making
hang
stuff
on. Up 35 years. But French still existed then. And as a language, it's probably about five new words, like, you know, internet.
Maybe.
I don't know, four others.
So we had Matt on and he was absolutely charming.
It was annoying. He's just too slick. I don't trust him. Matt, I'm just kidding. I'm just totally kidding.
No, he was absolutely charming. He had a lot of great points.
He starts off talking about his lived experience and the impact gambling had on him.
He was very open about that, and it's always a tough topic. And he was, we then kind of had a broad conversation, and it was fantastic. I walked away kind of going, okay, it all makes sense. It was very difficult to, I'll be honest, I didn't know what to expect when he came on.
Now, I was expecting Matt to be much more of a kind of anti-gambling zealot. Because that is the way that he comes across in some of the columns, etc. I mean, they really Sometimes he comes across not as somebody who wants to clean up gambling, as in the organization that he's founded, rather as somebody that wants us all to burn at the stake.
That wasn't the case in person. So no, not that's so, why I like this longer form format, and where we can talk and it's not about sound bites or tweets or even newspaper articles. So yeah, that was really cool. So I was kind of high-fived myself afterwards of that was a really cool thing to do. And
there is a place for sound bites and tweets and things taken out of context.
There Don't is. We're trying forget. To really juice those advertising numbers for your second bike. That's what we got to build up to.
I won't need a second bike because I managed to track down that first bike that I didn't get. I got it last summer. The blue and orange one. It's beautiful. I haven't put any pedals on it yet. I mean, that's how committed I am to cycling.
But you're buying a second bike? So you got a bike with no pedals and you're in the process of buying a second bike.
Well, no, see, I'm going to move house at an unspecified date in the next couple of months. I need to get that out of the way first. But I've got the rollers, for cycling indoors.
You're going to do the turbo training?
Yeah, it's the actual, the really awkward rollers rather than a turbo trainer.
Oh, okay.
Because I really need to work on bike handling more than anything.
I was going to say, that just teaches you how to ride in a straight line, though. It's not going to get you, I'm not going to teach you how to go around corners. That's the trick, right?
No. You say anyway, that, right?
Something's better than nothing. I'm sorry.
Triathletes in the world. Well, I say some of them. One of the top triathletes in the world, but he is in like the top five, does all of his bike training indoors.
On rollers or on I've seen, what's his name? Not Froome. Who was the guy before Froome with the sideburns?
Wiggins.
He would train. They had this really wide, there was a training documentary with him, or a documentary following him around. And he had this really...
Excuse me, sir. It's Public Enemy interrupting.
He had this really wide treadmill, and he would ride his bike on the treadmill, and then they would do all the gradients and all that kind of stuff. So they would like plot in. I don't know. It's Ventoux, stage 7 of the Tour de France.
Sweet.
And so the course would follow the.
Sounds cheap too.
Yeah, super cheap.
Have you seen those curved treadmills?
I nearly killed myself the other day on one of those. They're a nightmare because it's all about how fast. You're the brake or the accelerator, but you end up running in a really unnatural way.
I think it might have been made for me.
No, I found it. I tried one last week and I had to stop because I could feel my knee going because it wasn't a natural run. I couldn't quite, and I just had to use the regular treadmill, which also isn't great, but it was better than this. But yeah, it was super cheap compared to like what the F1 guys have to do with their race simulators and stuff, which cost millions. So it's quite interesting. Yeah.
So we spoke to both those people, and it is an interesting episode, and we do talk about policy and things that we can do in the world.
Yep.
And that's it really.
It is.
Yeah, you could probably just go listen to the episode now because it follows this.
Go, go, go.
We sidestepped neatly from the meanderings of myself and Fintan to greet our first guest of this episode, a returning guest, which is always a nice surprise because we often think, why would anybody come back? We say hello to Sarah Ramanauskas, Partner, Audit and Research at Gambling Integrity. Sarah, welcome. Thank you so much for coming back.
Great to be here once more, guys.
So Sarah's joining us today to discuss something that Fintan described quite beautifully as a car crash of a decision, which is the UK's National Health Service, which is distancing itself from the gambling industry, basically saying that they can't be having gambling studies or any gambling support from the industry. So it creates this lovely thing where the gambling industry is repeatedly beaten with a large stick and told, this is all your fault, you need to sort it out. And then
when they do things to try and sort it out, they get told, you can't do that, you buffoons. Sarah, what is going on? Any thoughts?
Well, that's a great question. And yes, I do have thoughts. And I think everybody involved in this particular dogfight has thoughts. But I just wanted to kind of give a bit of background on me for any of the millions listening who don't already know me. I don't think I actually do have a dog in this fight. My background is in market research. So for like 7-8 years at Betfair, William Hill, and then an independent research agency, I basically hung out with gamblers and talked to gamblers. And that's really what I've been doing at Gambling Integrity for, again, the last 7-8 years, is trying to represent, you know, your average gambler. The guy in the betting shop in Glasgow who lost his wife and said, well, yes, I am here every afternoon, but if I wasn't, I'd just be at home by myself with the telly. And, you know, that's no sort of life. Or the family whose daughter comes around on Mondays and they play bingo together, they play online bingo together sitting on the sofa. And they said, you know, we don't smoke, we don't go down the pub, we like doing this. And I think those are the people who are being sidelined and forgotten and to a certain extent demonized with all of this going on, you know, the anti industry, the industry figures, the Twitter this and the, you know, the Guardian that. There's lots and lots of people out there who just kind of want to get on and gamble. And I guess that's where I'm coming from, and that's going to be kind of my stance in trying to explain this to you. So I think, you know, listening to what I'm about to say, it might sound a bit kind of pro-industry. It might not be, you know, too much. She's not very concerned about people with gambling problems, but that's really not where I'm coming from. So why is this happening? Why have the NHS clinics basically gathered up their skirts in a huff and gone, oh, we're not going to have anything to do with the gambling industry? Well, this is the culmination of a kind of anti-industry campaign that's been going on for some time, to paint the industry in a bad light, to say, you know, they are biased, the research is biased, our patients are concerned, we can't possibly take this money. So it's been going on for a while, and it's finally come to a head, and head of the NHS Mental Health Services has said, no more industry money. And I think they've kind of really painted themselves into a corner with this, because what they're expecting is a standard, an industry levy. What does that mean? That basically means that the government will insist that the gambling industry has to pay, let's say 1%, the usual figure that's bandied around, 1% of gambling yield to the Treasury as a levy. And the NHS is expecting that money to come to them for treatment, research, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's not necessarily going to happen. You know, if you look at the demands on the Treasury's wallets from COVID, potentially now from defence, if they've got all of that money coming in from the gambling industry, are they really going to hand that back straight back out to the clinics? So I think point one from me is that, you know, that they may well have created a situation for themselves where they don't actually get as much money as they think they're going to do. But my second point, and the one that really I'm more concerned about, is that this demonization of the gambling industry in turn demonizes gambling. And this is what I and my colleagues at Gambling Integrity and lots of other people are working on at the moment, is trying to reduce stigma. And we can't successfully reduce stigma if the gambling industry itself is being demonized in this way. So, you know, it's really hard to see where we go from here with this, unless there are more people speaking out to say, you know, yeah, the gambling industry, they're not all saints, I have to say. But on the other hand, how do we make sure that, you know, most people just can kind of get on and do what they enjoy doing without finger pointing, without demonization? So I guess those are kind of the two main points I wanted to make was, you know, I'm not sure this has been a terribly good political move on behalf of the NHS, but we'll see, because statutory levy may take ages to come in and might not deliver the goods to them. And, you know, can we please stop saying all gambling, you know, gambling is harmful? It's not.
So, look, and I totally agree and with you, and particularly on the reducing stigmatization and stuff as well, because the more it's, you know, if you are stuck and you need help, you're going to feel even worse about it. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'll wait even longer before seeking help. Mm-hmm. And kind of we put people at the heart of this. So what was the relationship? Because it's basically they've cut links with Gamble Aware, which is industry funded. Mm-hmm. What was the relationship between Gamble Aware and the NHS? Like, because obviously, you know, are there people at risk? Is there, like, treatments not going to happen? Or how does that, what does actually severing this relationship mean?
Well, it sounds like the NHS is going to pony up for the costs of the clinics. So at the moment, just looking at the numbers, there are 5 NHS clinics across the UK, about to go up to 7. They treated a grand total of 668 people last year, with funding of 1.2 million for that from Gamble Aware. So the money basically comes from the industry into Gamble Aware, and then Gamble Aware give 1.2 million to the NHS clinics, which comes out at £1,796 per person treated, which is actually quite a lot. So I guess the NHS from somewhere and the NHS mental health services are for the time being going to step up and fund that until they hopefully get the statutory levy money. So no, I don't, it's not that people are not going to be treated. It's just that taxpayers' money is now going to be funding gambling treatment rather than industry money.
But and look, I don't expect you to know the answer, but there are scenarios where you could say, well, if this money is coming from the NHS, this money that was funded by the gambling industry is now coming from the NHS, that means there's other NHS services that have just lost, say, 1.2 million in funding or whatever that number is.
Yeah.
They're swimming in money, those guys. Everybody knows that. But I'm wondering though if this might signal a change in the types of treatment. Because if you think about that number, the number of people that were treated, it's not a lot of people. And yet, I think if you combined all of the charities working in the field, they would be talking to a hell of a lot more people than that.
And hopefully
kind of interjecting and helping people before they need that sort of clinic, that NHS clinic, which we might think of as kind of the end point, I guess. But does that mean then, does this mean if the NHS is taking this on, are they going to take on all those other steps as well?
No, I mean, you've still got Gamble money going into GamCare. So GamCare, on the other hand, they support about 100,000 people, 70 to 100,000 people through their various services each year, both gamblers and affected others. And about, I think they've got about 10,000 who are in specialist counselling support. So, you know, there are large numbers, thankfully, that will still be going through Gamble Aware. But you're right. I mean, the guys that turn up at the NHS clinics, they've been referred to via the NHS. They are, you know, they have really serious problems. And I can kind of understand why, you know, the guys, for example, that run the NHS North clinic are very anti-industry, because you know, they see people at their lowest. It's a bit like if, you know, if you were to, you know, wander down to your local pub and every time you went in, it was just full of people stumbling about and puking in corners, you know, but that's not how it is. So they see kind of the worst of the worst. They hear all these terrible stories, and it's, you know, it's understandable why they kind of go, oh, damn, the industry is terrible. Because, you know, I don't suppose they've actually been in a betting shop.
It's a pretty fair point. You know, I would be willing to bet some serious cash, no pun intended, that most of the politicians in the UK that are speaking out about these and are having an opinion on these things have never been in a bookies, never been in a casino.
There was actually a Twitter something, I'm not entirely sure why he was tweeting this, but he said, you know, I think only normal people should be allowed to become politicians. People who know what it's like to have only 50 quid left at the end of the month. People who've been on a mega bus. You know, people who don't own stocks and shares, just normal people who understand normal life. And I think another part of this demonization that concerns me is that it's actually quite classist. And a couple of people have said this way better than I could, but it does rather feel like people are going, oh dear, poor people are gambling. You know, they really shouldn't do that. Lots of betting shops in deprived areas are terrible. You know, what do you want them to do? Like, sit at home and make stick figures out of pipe cleaners. It's really patronizing. It's really classist, in my view.
Hey, I speak as, you know, I'm in societal terms, I'm real scum. And, I hate all this classist shit, frankly. It just makes me want to swear. Something I did want to bring up with you, which is it is linked to this, but it's a slight sidestep. The recent things that I've been seeing about gambling harm reduction, because there's been a lot of things bleated by the industry saying, yeah, but like problem gambling's like lowered. And I was reading something the other day that pointed out, yeah, it lowered at the same time as availability was reduced thanks to COVID. Yeah. Is it, I mean, because, you know, I we have spoken before, and Fintan and I are both big fans of yours. Is that, are both sides of that like an oversimplification? That's kind of how it feels when I read these things.
Yeah. It's really, really hard to say. I keep getting asked this question, like, what happened to gambling during COVID? And the answer is lots of different stuff. So what happened during COVID, so far as we can tell, and this is from different jurisdictions, you know, including places like Canada, is that people who gambled land-based obviously gambled less because couldn't. But online gambling went up, fair enough. People who were gambling probably more than they should have done before COVID, some of them just stopped and went, oh, okay, this is a really good opportunity for me to cut back. And other people who, you know, were struggling with their gambling struggled more. So it's a really complicated picture, and I don't think you can say definitively that problem gambling went down because of COVID lockdowns. I think, and I, you know, I'm sure people will have different opinions, I think the number of people who are classified as problem gamblers is so small that any statistical movement is not actually that meaningful, right? Because if you look at the way in which we find out how many people are problem gamblers, first of all, it's through a survey. So you have to find people who want to answer a survey. And then you ask them a bunch of questions about their gambling, which means it's self-reported. And then it's a teeny weeny little number. So, I mean, I don't think we can say it's gone up or down. It's just still a very small number of people. people who answer a survey in the right way.
It's so all who knows, really. Is it all survey based?
Yes.
No.
That's like relying on the subject to us, you know, asking people if they've got crabs. Do you know what I mean? Nobody's going to say, "Oh yeah, do you want to see them?" Of course they're not going to say that. And a big part of the issue with problem gambling is, of course, that most people really, really hide it until they're hugely in trouble.
But you've got to find people willing to answer a survey. That's the first step. And anybody willing to answer a survey is immediately suspect.
Like being a politician, isn't it?
Yeah, which is why GamblerWare are looking at what do we do other than having a prevalence survey. I hate prevalence surveys, but again, that's because my background is in quantitative research.
And you understand the limitations of that far better than anybody else. But oh my god, I've since we've got Sarah on the line, I've got a question for you as well, Sarah. I was reading a very large publicly listed company's statements today that. Showed up in the newspapers, and one of them was, and if it's a client, you can tell me to feck off, and we'll cut this bit out. Their corporate goal is to have 75% of their users by the year 2030 using at least one responsible gambling tool that's available on their platform.
Yeah,
and my brain just went, why isn't it 100%, and why isn't it next week? What will be the for big company, like why would that be a difficult? Are they just tone deaf and just kind of like we don't care anymore, or is it like this is actually a really difficult thing to implement?
It's actually a really difficult thing to do.
Okay,
and it all comes back to stigma once again, because gamblers think that responsible gambling tools are for people with problems. So what you have to try and do when you're messaging about responsible gambling tools, like the take time to think message, is say, this is just like a seatbelt. You just need to put a seatbelt on. But that is very hard to do quickly if the view is, you know, I don't need them. And if it's not regulated, the only way you will get to 75 to 100% of people using a responsible gambling tool is to mandate it. It's the only way that will happen.
Mm. I have a suggestion for another way that could work. And this is super controversial. So just bear with me.
Okay.
Attach a bonus to it.
No, that still wouldn't work. Seriously, wouldn't work.
Well, the only way to do it, it's a bit like organ donations, right? So you turn it from an opt-in to an opt-out.
Yeah.
And so you automatically look at their average deposit over the last 6 months. Let's say it's 50 quid. And then you just calculate a number off that's reasonable. Mm-hmm. And then they have to petition to change that if they ever reach. So let's say there's because the easiest one to do is a deposit limit, right? So you just, you know, automatically opt everyone into a deposit limit based on their account history. Mm-hmm. And then anybody opening a new account automatically has to set one or something. So it kind of felt like it's doable if there was a real will to do it. But I just thought, like, given the UK, like the Gambling Act stuff going on right now, the general tone in the market, 75% by 2030. Just seemed like
we actually
don't care and we're just going to kick it down the road for as long as possible.
Well, and you know, we've all been through the last 2 years, and 2022 somehow is managing to turn out even more shit than 2021. So who knows by 2030, you know, nowadays 2030 could just as well be 3030. So
we're living in our post-nuclear apocalypse. Anna.
Yeah.
Why is my water green? That's fair. Okay, but no, but I really do get your point that it's a difficult thing to do. If you want people to do it voluntarily. And I get the psychology behind that's far more nuanced than I realized. Okay. I'll calm down about that topic then, because that really annoyed me this morning as well.
I mean, if you, as a marketeer, Fintan, can think of good ways of getting people to put the seatbelt on without mandating it, or without people going, "No, we want our freedoms," you know, over to you.
But you know, there's those horrific. Remember the seatbelt car crash ads? The little kids, yeah. And there was the like this, and then it was like the seatbelts for the front seat, and then it was the campaigns for the seatbelts for the back seat. And those kind of things. But it takes time, right? That's one of those kind of, unless you're in Spain, and like I've been in taxis in Spain where the guy just has the little seatbelt buckle that he clips in, so the car stops beeping, but he's not actually wearing a seatbelt, which just seems the most excessively, I'm not going to abide by the rules I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Fintan, because, you know, gamblers don't like to abide by rules. They like to take risks. That's the point. So, you know, you're already trying to address a population that wants to take risks with something that is trying to make them not take risks. So, tricky.
This is why we bring Sarah on. She just brings insight and knowledge onto us, John. I'm already a smarter person than I was when I woke up this morning.
One of the things that Sarah brings, and we don't mean to be, we're not blowing smoke up your ass, Sarah, as their American cousins say, is you're very straight talking. Like, you, there's no messing about. It's just no. See, when I said attach a bonus to it, what I meant is like when you start a new job, and you accrue your holiday days a bit at a time. You accrue a little bit of bonus for each day that you have your problem gambling tools on your account.
Oh, you said problem gambling tools.
Yeah.
See?
Oh, did you mishear us at the beginning? Do we have to?
No. No, just saying John called them problem gambling tools.
Oh, tut-tut, John, they're not problem gambling tools, they're responsible gambling tools.
You see, that, you know, that's how you think of them.
Shit, sorry.
No, it's
sorry, good. Industry.
It's good. It sort of makes my point for me. So thank you.
Have I just proven that I'm a bigger bonehead than anybody thought?
No.
No, because you already thought that was a massive bonehead.
No, but it goes back to the stigma point, right? It's all about, like, it's all about positioning and stigma, and the normalizing of, like, even calling them responsible gambling tools. They should just be automatically baked in. And I always use Tombola as the example of this. So they just built in these features automatically into the platform, and just that was it. Like, there was no if, buts, or maybe. And they proved over time that, you know, they became UK's number one bingo brand, and they replicated that at Spain and Italy. So it showed, like, for me, they've just been bought by Flutter and stuff, probably hopefully for the same reasons. That it's, if you make it optional, and it goes back to the thing of, like, risk to, like, everything Sarah's saying is like, hey, look, here's a perfect example. Let me tell you my Lapland story. So we went to Lapland before Christmas, and we dropped our bags in the cabin, and my wife's unpacking, and there was a little sled, a little hill for kids to run up and down with bobsleds, or not bobsleds, but sleds. And so me and my son were barreling down this hill, having a great crack, and this lady walks past, and she goes, "Oh, guys, be really careful. My husband's in A&E right now. He's got a broken arm. Because he came down the hill and he went off course and he crashed into that fence." And we're both nodding and smiling at her. And then I'm walking back up the hill going, "Don't, that'll never happen to me. That guy must have been an idiot." 5 sled runs later, I make the exact same mistake as this guy must have made. Go completely off course, smash into this fence foot first, right on the edge of my foot. Go absolutely flying through the air, lying in the snow. Now, we are literally in Lapland less than 2 hours, and I've already, what I believe, broken my foot. And But I think just back to, anyway, luckily enough, I was terrified to take off my boot and stuff. So luckily I didn't break my foot, and I'm still limping a little bit. But I think if you go back to Sarah's point of my attitude of, well, that guy's a gobshite, that would never happen to me. And I think that just general attitude of, well, I won't lose control. I won't bet more than I should. I'm on top of things. And that's always going to be the response of most people, and particularly, like Sarah says, risk takers. Mm-hmm. Which is why I believe actually the approach is just remove the choice of just, this is how it works. Mm-hmm. And then will they go elsewhere? Probably. But if you look at Tombola, they'll actually come back to you because they'll realize, yeah, I prefer this brand. And over time, you just accumulate the user base based on they're having a better time over a longer period of time. So their money goes further. They get, you know, the whole package becomes better. And then your brand gets stronger and you just got that built-in loyalty. Sorry, that was a bit of a ramble. But yeah, I nearly broke my foot in Lapland within 2 hours of being in Lapland.
That's the TLDR version. it's good to know. I'm just glad your foot's okay.
It still flares up. But anyway, it's okay. It's not broken. That's the key thing.
Well, I'm sure everybody, as Sarah referenced earlier, I'm sure our millions of listeners are all very relieved. So, Sarah, there seems to be, right, in this, I mean, there's an awful lot going on at the moment. And I think there's a lot of stuff is cropping up and companies are saying, we're doing this, we're doing that. Is all of this activity that we're seeing at the moment because of the gambling review that's happening in the UK? Am I being naive?
I'm not sure it's necessarily linked to the gambling review. No, my kind of gossip that I hear back about people's views of the gambling review is that actually the government has more than enough to worry about, and this is just not top of the list, as you can see from the latest delay. It was supposed to be published by last month, and it's now going to be summer sometime, so who knows. No, I think part of it is being driven by the Gambling Commission and the fines, and you know, making sure that people, you know, the industry is conforming to the licensing codes and conditions of practice, anti-money laundering rules, etc. But I also think that the industry is growing up. I think you've now got some very, very large brands who are run as corporations who recognize the importance of not doing evil. Google, as you know, from Tinkers, now dropped that. And it's becoming an industry that recognizes that, you know, as you say, John, you need to keep people's money in their pockets for longer. You don't want to rip people off. And the other thing that's changing with online, and what I'm hearing a lot, is that gambling operators need the best technical talent, and they won't get that if they do bad things. And there's a lot of pressure on technology teams at the moment, the talent, and the gambling industry is going to come out last in that race for talent if people see that they are, you know, responsible for dozens of suicides every day or whatever it might be. So I think there's a whole range of things that are coming together slowly over time, which means that we see these things from the industry and they are actually doing it. You know, I work with these operators on a pretty much a daily basis, and these things are in place. They are doing behavioral tracking. They are making responsible gambling interventions. You know, they are trying to protect people. It's not just words. So I think, you know, the direction of travel is really good. It's just, as I say, I think we're still butting up against the issue of stigma, which prevents gamblers from really believing the operators that this is good for them, that this is the right thing to do, and that it's not an adversarial relationship when it comes to safer gambling. So that, again, that's a messaging issue around how to do this. So you know the industry is still not doing that terribly well. Apparently, you know, this weekend there was a responsible gambling ad from brand X immediately followed by a casino ad by brand X. So, you know, there's still a long way to go.
There's still a long way to go, but then you look at, say, BetVictor got fined, what, $2 million by the Gambling Commission the other day for stuff from, was it 2019 to March 2020? Mm-hmm. And you're kind of like, lads, like, you know, they've been around forever, big UK brands, they know what they're doing, they're smart, but like, they shouldn't be these problems anymore.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the BetVictor one, because that's actually raised quite a lot of concerns, because if you read the statement, there's quite a lot in there where you kind of go, that's a really grey area, you know. And things like bonus conditions didn't prevent someone from cancelling a promotion when someone had already signed up. He was like, oh my God, I read this stuff every day and I don't understand what they're on about. Or we're concerned about bonus conditions that are encouraging people to gamble. Like, that's what gambling advertising does. If you're saying you don't want gambling ads to encourage people to place a bet, you kind of don't want gambling advertising. So I think the BetVictor result is actually potentially a kind of turning point where, you know, a lot of people will go, hang on, what exactly does the Gambling Commission want us to do? We need more context, we need more guidance on this.
So is this then turning into another Sweden where people are learning the gambling rules through the courts when they get handed a message? Because Sweden has the same issue, right? So it's really vague regulation and just big fines and suck it up. Do you feel that this is the way this is going?
Yeah, that's how it seems, yes.
Wow, okay. Yeah, because honestly, I just read the headline, saw money laundering, saw social responsibility and just assumed, you know, it was the same old stuff, but clearly not.
Yeah, there was a bit of the same old stuff. And I think, again, what we say time again at Gambling Integrity, I never do any sales plugs on these things. It's just so crap at saying this anyway. But at Gambling Integrity, time and time again, we go, guys, you have this process, but the process is only as good as the people who are carrying it out. And, you know, crap happens. People have bad days. They don't check something, you know, they don't do the VIP check that they should have done, or, you know, they didn't bother writing something down, whatever it might be. And, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And yeah, like ultimately these failures are always, you know, the person sitting there at the computer or on the phone doing XYZ, and it's always, I do agree with that as well. I think a lot of the times it's well-intentioned mistakes. I never really obviously sometimes it might be malicious, but I think the majority of the times it's like I don't know, it was a Skybet or something sent out a massive email to self-excluded customers by mistake, you know. And that's just like, look, I've managed mailing lists, somebody ticked the wrong box, that's like super easy to happen, and I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, rather than it was like some malicious let's reactivate all these players type Dr. Evil scenario. So I do agree that it is all about the people at the coalface. And giving them the support and the tools and making it really difficult to make these mistakes. also helps. Brilliant. Thank you.
Sarah, thank you very, very much for joining us again.
Thank you, guys. I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to speak in a forthright manner and also hopefully to put the case for just, you know, the guy in the betting shop who wants to hang around the betting shop for that. You know, let's just make sure we can.
It's remembering that there are people on the other end of this, not just numbers, right?
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
In a nod to the established global patriarchy, we now go from our first guest to our second guest. We are joined by Matt Zarb-Cousin, director of Cleanup Gambling and co-founder of Gamban. Matt, something I've wanted to ask you for a long, long time.
Go for it, John. Now's your chance.
Where does the Zarb bit of your surname come from?
It's all actually one name, Zarb-Cousin. It's actually pronounced, although I prefer to just say Zarb-Cousin because I just think that's how you say it if you're English. Zarb-Cousin, it's Maltese. And the Zarb bit actually comes from Turkey and the cuisine comes from France. So it was an amalgamation of the two on the island of Malta.
It's a great answer. You certainly passed the first test here today.
Fantastic.
So Matt, director of Cleanup Gambling, co-founder of Gamban, and I think it's fair to say vocal critic of the gambling industry. And Matt is here. We're going to discuss quite a few things, but we're going to start with kind of, because you never know where somebody is listening from. We're going to start with Matt's sort of credentials, for want of a better way to put it, and Matt's experience. And we're not doing this because we are an anti-gambling podcast. We are obviously a gambling industry podcast. But Matt has lived experience, and so it's relevant to everything we're going to talk about. Matt, what's your story, please?
I got addicted to fixed odds betting terminals, which were obviously the machines in the betting shops where you could gamble up to £100 every 20 seconds on roulette. And I got addicted to those when I was 16, so I was underage. And over a period of about 4 years, I got into a huge amount of debt. I gambled away thousands of pounds, all the money I had access to, all the money I earned from part-time jobs and borrowed. Took over my life completely, really, really fully addicted to those machines and you know, obviously particularly roulette played at that speed. It did lead to the point where I was quite close to taking my own life. I became extremely kind of depressed and obviously, like, you know, you have successive sessions where you lose a lot of money and you do feel like awful and feel like you don't have any control or agency, and you know the decisions aren't being made by you but they're being made for you almost. Addiction is very strange like that. It's almost like something talking to you, convincing you to do something that's not in your interest, and you having no real power to resist that, no real kind of, or just very, you know, you can also convince yourself to do something that you shouldn't do, and yeah, that's completely irrational, and that's where I got to, and it led me to the point where, obviously, I was fortunate enough to get help and get through it and stop gambling. Even after that point, when I nearly killed myself, it took me about 6 months or so to stop. I did have a couple of relapses after, and once I stopped, I was able to go back to university, finish my degree. And then I got involved in campaigning against the machines or for a restriction on the maximum stake a couple of years later with the campaign for fair gambling. And obviously we did end up getting that change enacted several years later.
Matt, I've got two questions, one of which is going to seem frivolous, but it's just I've got an inquiring mind and I have to know. What was your degree in?
anthropology and political science. Anthropology is like a study of, for those that don't know, so I'm not being patronizing, it's something I didn't really understand before I even started doing the degree in it. Anthropology is a study of like human societies and civilizations, and obviously political science is a study of politics and the application of kind of different conceptual frameworks in trying to understand politics and processes around it. So yeah, there was a kind of joint honours degree at the University of Birmingham. There was a betting shop right near the campus as well. I think it was a William Hill shop. And I did find myself in there quite a lot, quite frequently, sadly.
I guess this is a two-part question. What was the point at which you thought, hang on a second, this is all shit, I need help? And what was the first step in that sort of ladder, for want of a better way to put it?
The first time I thought I needed help. So I started gambling on the machines when I was about 16, just as I turned 16. And then a few weeks later, I won about £600 or £700 in a couple of hours. It was ridiculous. You know, I wasn't even betting like huge stakes then as well. Like it was just a ridiculous run of luck. And obviously when you get that sort of money at any age, you know, particularly if you're 16, it's like a small fortune. And I think from that point onwards, so like the moment when I thought I was addicted, I knew I had a problem, was when I, subsequent to that win, started working in a call center. And I got good money working for, like, I think it was PowerGen, what became Eon call center in Rayleigh, and I was on really good money, and at the end of the month I was paid like £650 or something, and I remember like losing it all in a day, and I remember thinking, right, I've just done 16 hours a week part-time, like after school, you know, Saturday mornings for a whole month, and I've just lost all of that in a machine. Like, I think I've got a problem here, I think this is a problem. But I still went back when I had money again, you know, this is the thing, like sometimes I think gambling addiction is not, you don't necessarily have to do it every day to be addicted. There is, I think, a phenomenon that's perhaps a bit more under the radar, which is like binge gambling, which where you, when you get a hit of cash, you know, by that point, you've almost buried the memory of the previous loss and the harms associated with it. You've perhaps recovered a little bit your financial position, and then you're back into binging and losing all the money that you had again. And that sort of cycle happened repeatedly for a number of years, really, where all the money I had would just go into the machines. And yeah, there would be some days where I would win. Obviously, it's roulette. Obviously, mathematically, you can't win in the long term. And I'd go back the next day, and you know, that on those occasions where I'd have a big win, I would back in the next day and the day after if I won again. But like, yeah, I knew it was a problem pretty early on. I knew it wasn't normal behavior, like normal, quote unquote normal. I mean, but it's just having the ability to stop was just unfortunately not there. And I couldn't fully understand how strong the addiction was. I couldn't really come to terms with that.
And what help then did you, because when you talked about it, when you did stop, like what was the process you went through for that, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I dug myself such a hole. I was already like pretty much half, I was already neglecting a lot of my university work and obviously missing lectures and not engaging with it. And I wasn't where I wanted to be anyway. And I was in a huge amount of debt already, not just student debt, obviously, but I'd lost thousands and thousands of pounds by that point. And I had basically, I'd done like certain things to try to prevent access to money, to cash, like cutting my debit cards. And I've done all sorts of things. You know, when you're in that midst of a loss, having just experienced a huge loss, and you're in that kind of period where you're reflecting on it, you do try to do things that assert some responsibility and control over a situation that you've kind of lost control. And this is where, like, we'll get on to talking about it, but where Ganban comes in, and this is where I'm kind of quite passionate about that as well. But I feel like that I did so many things to try and put blocks in the way and obstacles in the way, and obviously I'd figure out ways to overcome them. So if it was cutting debit cards, I would go to the bank and just withdraw loads of cash over the counter. If it were, you know, there was lots of different things I could do to circumvent the barriers I put in place. And obviously I tried to self-exclude, but then I knew that the person that I self-excluded with wasn't working on this particular day, so I would go in the shop then. And, you know, there was just lots of, I basically lost all the money that I had ever earned and had access to, all the money that I'd borrowed. I took out a series of different student loans, student overdrafts, sorry, from different banks. I'd borrowed money from friends, family. I'd lost all the money that I earned in part-time jobs. And basically, it was all the money that I had access to, I could access. So I'd maxed out all possible avenues for getting money. And at that point, I wasn't able to gamble anymore. I physically couldn't gamble unless I turned to crime or something. So thankfully, it didn't happen. So I was in a position where I had to kind of face up to where it got me. And then this was actually in subsequent to a very big loss, where I'd basically lost about $2,000 in a day, which was all kind of student loan. And that was when I was very close to killing myself. So it was, from that point on, were it not for an intervention from my family and, them coming out to Birmingham and taking me to treatment and all that stuff, then maybe I would not be here now. So it's that was it really. I was helped into recovery without question, and I had to get to it was only once I got to that rock bottom moment that I could start to rebuild my life again and reflect on where it had got me. And it was extremely difficult, but thankfully, it happened.
Fair enough. And obviously then, you've been on this path. I think, from within the industry, you might be seen sometimes as, and I'm not taking the piss when I say this, but kind of like a crusader against gambling. Now, life is very, very rarely black and white. What is your actual position, considering your lived experience and what you do, as your sort of bread and butter with cleanup gambling and Gamban? What's your position on gambling? Should we all be burned at the stake, for example?
No, this is I think it's a misappropriation of my position to say I'm against gambling. I can understand why people might think that, and it's not my job to tell people whether they should gamble or not. I mean, I've no interest in the kind of moral arguments for gambling, or I don't think it's an immoral thing to gamble. I don't think it's something that should necessarily be discouraged either. I'm not saying it's just something that should be encouraged, but I'm not saying that. I think that there is a legitimate pursuit that I think that the gambling industry can offer people, entertainment pursuit. And at the moment, I don't think it's been run fairly, and I don't think it's regulated properly. I think that the regulations are stacked in favor of the operators. And I think that we tolerate in the gambling industry a level of consumer protection that we frankly would not tolerate in any other sector. I think the standard of consumer protection in gambling should be higher than in other sectors, because it's the consumer and the vendor. There's between the consumer and the vendor being the gambling operator, there is an adversarial relationship, and the gambling operator is trying to win as much as they can from the consumer and vice versa. But the problem with the way gambling is currently regulated is that it's impossible for the consumer to win money off of the operator. It's very, very difficult in long term to do that. You have a situation where there is the over promotion of products which are addictive and extractive and designed to cause medium to long term losses, such as slots and roulette, and significant losses ideally for the operator. And then there are products where you could, in theory, get an edge over the bookmaker, so betting on racing, betting on sports or whatever. But if you do that, then you get restricted or closed. And that is not fair. That's a fundamental unfairness in the system. And from my perspective, to have a gambling license, it's a privilege. It's not a right. It's not something that we should just hand out to everyone. Who, you know, if they just write to the Gambling Commission, whoever they are, and say, give me a license, that should just be handed out on a name to permit basis.
I've got one. I just wrote to the Gambling Commission and I said I'd really like one of those.
All the lawyers listening are just rolling their eyes right now. I have to do all that paperwork.
If I ever see anybody playing dice or cards anywhere, I whip out my wallet like I'm the FBI and just stand back.
About 2,000 remote gambling licensees, and there's a huge number of licensed operators. There's some that frankly shouldn't have been licensed in 2014, and you're seeing a few in the last few months have been shut down who have been licensed since 2014. The Gambling Commission hasn't exercised appropriate due diligence over who they've licensed. I think that's pretty clear. I think it's pretty clear from Football Index. I just think it's too easy to get licensed, and the regulations just aren't adequate. They're not really fit for purpose. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I want to make it fairer.
I think that the issue with the regulator, and I'm not saying this to piss anybody at the regulator off that's listening, pretty sure none of them are. But I think that the issue is that they don't understand the business. I really do fundamentally think that. I don't think they understand the software side of it. I don't think they understand how any of the businesses are set up. I don't think they understand how the games work. I don't think they go to casinos, to bookies, et cetera, et cetera. And if you don't have that, if you don't have a basic understanding of the technology, you're fucked when you try and regulate it, surely.
Yeah. We actually got a tip-off from someone. And I'm going to say this because I'm not going to mention any of the operators that were involved.
Sure. Who are the operators?
I think just to give us all legal cover, I'll just explain in very broad terms what happened. So we got a tip off from one of the operators that a particular blackjack game was being operated at a margin that wasn't known to the player. So basically, there was a number of aces and picture cards that were removed from the virtual deck, which meant that the house edge was bigger. And wow. Yeah, so we got this tip-off, and obviously what did we do when we were kind of, this was a few years ago, when we had a bit of faith in the Gambling Commission, we flagged it to the Gambling Commission. We said, you should probably investigate this because this has come from a really good, reputable source, and obviously we want to protect the source, but we need you to kind of take it on board and maybe request the data, or I don't know, do what you need to do, basically, to make sure this game is being operated fairly. And they came back and said, well, have you got any evidence this game is being operated in Britain? And I said, well, no, but it's one of your licensees. So maybe you should investigate it. But they didn't want to. They see their role not as investigators, but as almost like an arbitrator, as a judge. So present us with the evidence, and then we might take enforcement action. But we need to get the other side's story first. But really what you need as a regulator, I think, is more of the FBI style than the judiciary style, if that makes sense. You need something that's willing and is able to understand what's going on within the business, exactly as you say. I think there's an unwillingness.
The resource side of that's very different, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about such a vastly different level of funding. But the difference between those two models highlights the efficacy of the commission as it stands, doesn't it?
It does, exactly. But yeah, this is why I've made the argument as well for the commission to have more resources and to be a different type of regulator. And when I was speaking to the Gambling Commission about, for example, Football Index, they kept coming back to this argument that they're not an economic financial regulator. They don't assess or monitor the solvency of the licensees. And it's like, well, how can you ensure gambling is fair and open if you don't ensure that adequate funds are ring-fenced? Because those bets, therefore, you don't know if those bets can be honoured.
Yeah, so I thought that was part of the licensing deal. You know, like, to have a license to be an operator, you have to have X amount of solvency. I thought that was just like an absolute no-brainer.
I think there's different. You can, when you look up somebody's license, you can see if the player funds are fully segregated, or sometimes then there's kind of, I think there's different standards, right? So there's fully segregated, and then there's kind of commingled or whatever it is. And there's actually levels within the UK license, I believe, but I'm definitely not a lawyer.
That's it. There's different levels of ring fencing that are required. But if the Gambling Commission properly understood Football Index business model, they would have required 67%, 68%, I think, of the shares that were minted in footballers initially to be ring fenced. The proceeds of those share sales to be ring fenced, but they didn't fully understand business model. They didn't understand
If they fully understood Football Index, they also wouldn't have let them call it trading and use the word dividends. And you know, there's a big long list of things that would have been done differently.
it's like if you want to have an environment that encourages innovation and new products and all that stuff, that's fine. But you need the oversight that comes with it. You can't, it's like the mistake that I think we make is we think, well, if we want to encourage innovation, we need a scaled down regulator. No, the opposite is true. You need a regulator that is properly on top of all of the trends within the industry, where the industry is moving, what that means, whether that means that the consumer is still protected. All of these things need to be considerations. And I'm not saying that means that we have to have no innovation, but it does need to come at a price, I think, of having a regulator that's fit for purpose and has adequate resources.
Well, it'd be interesting to just at least try having one that's fit for purpose. I'm willing to give that a go, definitely. but I would want to pick you up on something here, because you said about, like, you're not like anti-gambling necessarily. But like, the first time I encountered your name was, I can't remember what year it was. But you'd done like a video report at ICE, and I think it might have been in the Mirror.
Right.
It's probably about, 6 years ago, maybe. And it was like about,
I was actually 4 years ago. Yeah. I
think. Only four years. Jesus. Yeah, it's been a big 4 years. A lot's happened.
Pre-COVID.
Jesus. PC. But I remember reading that and thinking, eh? What? So and watching the video and thinking, well, hang on a second. Because the thing is, like, I had this almost bipolar response to it. Because on the one hand, like when I started in publishing, I started out in gaming magazines. Mm. And you'd go to the big gaming events, and at that time, so this is like early 90s, at that time, everybody attending these events pretty much was a young spotty teenage boy with almost exclusively no girlfriend. And what they used to do on all of the booths was employ attractive young women wearing catsuits and the like to appeal to their gaming instincts, I think. It pissed me off then. But to be, you know, in my 40s and still seeing this, and I'd say to my publisher, you know, it's like they think, you know, and the number of companies doing this has decreased by, God, tens, if not hundreds in these things. The companies doing it are usually from the same sort of geographic region. But you think, like, it's you know, back then, what, 2018, 2017, do we still need to do this? But then you'll walk by at some point and there will be a gaggle of men having their photo taken with them, and you think, oh, for fuck's sake. So you kind of like, on the one hand, why are we still doing this? On the other hand, oh, shit, it works. But it's like, it's annoying and all that. But I remember seeing the thing and it was like, but hang on a second, this is a trade event. You've got to be over 18. You've got to be in the industry. Everybody in the room is an adult. And while the objectification aspect of it is distasteful, you know, no laws are being broken, but it just felt like it was a tenuous way to kind of drag it, not drag the industry down. What's the word I'm looking for? Kick the industry puppy.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, I know where you're coming from, but all I say is I feel like, and this is not a view that, you know, I have exclusively, actually, in fact, people I speak to in the industry have this view that it's about 10 to 20 years behind other sectors in terms of social responsibility, in terms of like how it carries itself, how it integrates itself into society. Like, and I feel like this aspect of the biggest trade show, gaming trade show in the world, it does illustrate that to a large extent. I think it does feel like it's quite illustrative of the culture that still prevails within the industry. And you wouldn't find that at the arms industry conference. I'm not saying that the two things are necessarily analogous, but like the, you know, you wouldn't find it that, that's also at the Excel Center. You wouldn't find that sort of those sorts of practices there. And look, I mean, I think the industry's come on in the number of years, and even the years since 2018, you know, there's far more women in executive roles in the gambling industry now. Obviously, Entain is an example. So I think that there is obviously progress, but as I say, like, it is a view shared by people I speak to in the industry that it is still some years behind other sectors.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say the prevailing. Because I'm not sure it is a prevailing attitude anymore. But I do see where you're coming from there. It just kind of felt like a shitty stick that we were being poked with, you know? But I mean, I've seen some of your pieces in The Guardian and they really do feel decidedly anti. And that is a pointy stick. But, you know, speaking to you now, obviously you're perfectly reasonable, intelligent adult. And it's a very different conversation in a two-way dialogue. I can't think of any Guardian points specifically off the top of my head, so I'm not going to address those directly.
My target's always with campaigning. My target's always been the government, and you know, changing legislation or changing regulation. Like, I'm quite realistic about the limits to what individual gambling operators can do within, you know, like unilaterally. If they were to do things that reduce harm, then it's going to reduce the profits in the short term, right? That's just a fact. So therefore, like, it is difficult for them to do that. So I don't, you know, I think they're operating, really, gambling operators are operating in a way that they're permitted to, and the way that we should, the way that I expect them to, we're given the current conditions. So if I don't like that, then I should change the conditions. And that's kind of what we try and do, and you know, as I say, I'm quite pragmatic about what changes need to happen, and you know, who's responsible ultimately, and who the target of the campaigning should be.
So, if Boris called you up tomorrow, and we'll kind of create this fantasy land, and said, "Matt, you're in charge, sort it all out."
That's not a fantasy land, Fintan. That is exactly how this government was put together.
Well, I think just purely on political affiliations, I think it's probably not going to happen. But what would your, you know, what's your 5-step plan or whatever you, however you'd phrase it?
Only given 5 steps. Come on. 5 steps.
Okay. Man. Step number one, introduce a gambling ombudsman independent of the industry.
How have we not got a gambling ombudsman? Seriously. Great. How?
I'm glad you agree. It's mad. It's madness.
It's fucking mental. We should have had one for decades.
Exactly.
Sorry, when that came up as like a proposed thing under the gambling review, I think I said on this very podcast, how have we not got one already?
It's mad.
It's so obvious.
I think it was a 30-minute monologue on how stupid it was we didn't have one.
It's just, honestly, of all the, I mean, just, that's just fucking basic. Sure, I mean, sorry.
Yeah. So, so point one. We're good.
I thought I'd start with a low-hanging fruit there, right? So we're all on the same page, right? It gets progressively more kind of maybe contentious. So number two, I would go for stake limits on online slots, so they're commensurate with the same content on venue-based machines. So £2 a spin for property content. Don't know what your thoughts are on that. But I think if you're going to bring the legislation, analog legislation, into the digital age, as they've promised to do, then that seems to be an obvious.
On the stake limits, then, would that sync up online FOBTs and casinos? So then they're all playing to the same rules?
I think there would have to be parity there, because that was the big issue the casino industry had with the FOBTs, is like, look, you know, we're overseen to an incredible degree. We can't play at the same speed as FOBT. So, you know what I mean? Like, let's have a bit of parity. That was what the casino industry wanted for sure. So,
I think it makes very little sense to limit the stakes on venue-based machines when they at least employ, you know, they employ more people. You know, it's very labor unintensive to run like online gaming. It's, apart from the content suppliers and all that sort of stuff, it creates far more jobs than machines, and they don't create many jobs, but far more jobs than online equivalent. So it doesn't make sense to not have that parity. So that's the next one. Then the third one I would say is, a statutory levy on the industry, which is independently administered, so administered by an independent public body of some sort, which would allocate the levy money to research councils and the NHS and to treatment providers like Ganka.
Okay.
So based on that one, if we take the NHS stuff last week where they said they weren't going to take any money from GamCare anymore because they're industry funded. GambleAware, not GamCare, sorry. Do you think an independent body would be okay, or for the NHS or not?
Yeah, I think the problem the NHS have is, from our discussions with them, is that the money that gets allocated to GambleAware, because the system the Gambling Commission has created basically gives operators the power to decide who to fund, based on like who's on the list, obviously, but they can withdraw or allocate funding at their kind of discretion. And because that's how GambleAware received the funding, and by extension then the NHS, that was what they were uncomfortable with, because they felt like it was giving the industry too much power over how that money is allocated. Now, do I think that the industry should be funding treatment? Absolutely. And if there's a way of doing it that removes the appearance that they have some control over how it's funded, then I think that would be a good step forward. And also we can like try and build in a bit more consistency in like how much funding comes through the system, because at the moment it is a bit like, it's a bit random. Like, I mean, it's going up, but it, like, knowing how much money is going to come in and over a number of years would obviously help us with planning and things like that.
Okay. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Good. All right. Cool. Number four would be, I would end gambling advertising around football. I would revert to a kind of pre-2007 settlement where you have carve outs. Now, pre-2007, you had carve outs for things like the National Lottery, I think the football pools as well, and I think bingo, if I'm not mistaken, venue-based bingo. And I think I'd return to a similar system, but have a carve out for racing. So I think the compromise, I mean, I think there's an argument to end all gambling advertising, but I mean, look, as I say, pragmatic, looking at it through a pragmatic lens, I think a good compromise would be end it around football and then have a carve out for racing. So the racing can still be shown on TV. That's not going to be like removed because there's no ads. It can still be shown at the tracks and, you know, whatever, like all that stuff. And And then it's like, basically, it's then a debate over what the carve out should be or the exemption should be. And if some need to be added or removed as time goes on, then that can be done, you know, without having a protracted gambling review. That's kind of where I want to get to with ads.
Okay. I mean, one of the interesting things about the shirt sponsorship argument, particularly for the Premier League, and I'd never even really thought about this before, is that so many of the brands were not UK brands at all, but it was capitalizing on the Premier League popularity globally and particularly in Asia. Mm. And yeah, we're not talking about sites that have English language interfaces at any point. You know, these are solely for Asian customers. I thought that was really, really interesting. But personally, I think taking a sponsorship off the shirts and taking the advertising out of the grounds is a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I agree, but I think all it'll happen is it'll just be like crypto.com, Binance, FTX, or whatever. Just the crypto guys will just fill that space the next day.
That's kind of what's happened in La Liga, and I think that is a cautionary tale. And to be honest, you know, if we had a regulator that was fit for purpose, and you had the Gambling Commission working with the FCA like it's supposed to, as it didn't with the football index, then you would be able to capture some of these innovations, for want of a better word, within the scope of that, of those advertising restrictions. I think that, you know, that is where we're headed anyway. I mean, the FCA is now obviously regulating the crypto exchanges, but it's not regulating the cryptocurrency itself. And I think that there is an argument that that is a form of gambling and, just buying and selling crypto. So, like, I think that all of these things, yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, for financial trading in general, like, you can open we could open up a CFD trading account tomorrow, leverage up, which is the scariest thing in the world, and, you know, lose not just all our money, but all the money we could ever have overnight. So anyway, look, I'm very anti-CFD trading.
I think I'd just like to chip in here, though, that this potential regulation should also cover very much NFTs, and we should use it as a means to change the definition of an NFT, because I think that that little, it's not even an acronym really, is it? But I think NFT needs to be redefined. It's like, lads, I bought an NFT. NFT, what's that? Not a fucking thing.
That's changing though. There is a use case for NFTs. But right now it's a bit like options trading, right? There's a use case for options, but it's clearly also a massive punting tool.
Listen, I think honestly, right? This is going to mark me out as some kind of a fucking hippie. I'm okay with that. I don't have any hair, never mind long hair. But I do believe that socially, an awful lot of society's ills, or rather an awful lot of the shit decisions that are made by businesses, are generally made by companies that are floated on stock exchanges, because there seems to be a disconnect between who they think their shareholders are and who they think the community and society at large is, when in fact they're exactly the same thing. Once you're making a decision based on a shareholder and a dividend rather than just doing the right thing and not being a prick, I think that's where problems begin. And I was thinking of that when Matt was saying about how, gambling companies, while they take a hit on profits in the short term. Well, what's the problem with that, really? If the longer term is safer play, probably people playing for longer in terms of their actual customer lifespan and the value being spread out over a longer period, but it's the same value. It's a short-term hit. Well, the problem with that is dividends.
Mm. That's true. I mean, the problem as well with doing that, you know, actually there might be a commercial case for reducing harm, you know, if you're looking at longer term picture. But if you're, say, 365, which isn't on the floated and isn't thinking about dividends other than, you know, how much money they can take out as owners, then it's just a question of like, if we do the right thing, we're just going to push that person to another operator. We're going to push them. So this is what I mean about having regulation to level the playing field. And that brings me neatly onto number five, which I think is probably the most contentious, which is affordability.
Do you need a drum roll?
I'll just do it quickly. Affordability checks. So this has obviously caused a huge amount of debate. There's been a lot of interest in, you know, where the threshold should be, and
we already fixed it.
We had a guy on last week. Yeah, he's using open banking. He can do it in a couple of clicks. It's got a whole. It's brilliant. Charles Cohen. And he can also solve single customer view as well using the same tech.
Excellent. See, I spoke to another organization called Better Risk. I thought they were great. They do a similar thing. Ex-city analysts and there are solutions that can work, but they, from my perspective, they need. We can debate where the threshold should be, whether it's £100 or something else. But like, they need really, I think, the buy-in of a public body to be run, so it's run independent of the industry. Now, if you're trying to build the architecture from scratch, you might say that the logical place to put it would be the ombudsman, if that ever gets created, which would then have more oversight of the data and all of this stuff. But I don't want to get into sort of utopian territory, but I think there's possible that could come to pass with what we see from the Gallery Review white paper. But let's just see. I mean, hopefully some logic is applied and it isn't just given and outsourced to the industry, because we've seen what they do with data already, and it isn't really utilized for the purposes of consumer protection. It's actually utilized for the purposes of commercial ends, exactly as you would expect. So I think that does need to be taken out of their hand.
That does bring us to another point, which is I saw a press release that you put out recently. And I think you tweeted it was covered in one of the Mail's offshoots, I think. Mm. Yeah, the one about the, was it Sky Bet? Data tracking and all that? I spoke to Fintan about this, and like, I did have a chuckle about it. Not about what happened to that dude, because that's just fucked up. It's just fucked up. What we were chuckling about was the irony of a group like the Mail running an article about data tracking. Because you know what? Nobody is more sophisticated than those guys. Nobody. No government organization. Nobody. So that made me chuckle quite a lot. But again, right? So the issue that I had with that was the story is this heinous mishandling, and you know, it was shocking. Wrong, and nobody in this industry is going to say anything other than that's fucked up. I mean, some people don't like swearing, so they might say that's messed up, but they want to say fucked, right? Mm. So that, I don't think anybody in the world would say anything other than that's just not right. Mm. But the angle that I felt it was pitched at about gambling companies, they're evil, they're tracking our data. It's like, well. Any tech-savvy company in any industry is tracking the exact same data in the exact same way, including the format where you are probably reading this. And that sort of felt like a stick with nails in to beat the industry with, when the stick to beat the industry with is what happened to this guy, not the data. You know what I mean? It felt like you'd sort of hung the story on a hook that was kind of redundant, you know, and it felt like it was just like finding something to kick the industry with when actually the thing to kick the industry with is that very heart of the story. Do you see where I'm not communicating this very well. You know where I'm coming from?
No, I know where you're coming from. I do see what you're saying. It's about how that data is used and for what purposes. And that really leads to the point about oversight. If there's not adequate oversight of how data is used by the industry, as data is used by all industries, of course, but if there's not adequate oversight of how data is used by the gambling industry, then it can be used for purposes that are not to reduce harm, to do the opposite in some cases. So that was my point. I was trying to communicate that when the Gambling Commission, and this is another feature of the regulator, if it wants to do something, it's for its instinct, it will be to call up the gambling industry and ask them if they'll do it. They did it with GamStop. GamStop's in a good place now. It's a great product. It took 4 years from 2014 when the industry was asked to build a self-exclusion register to come up with a prototype. So this is what happens. It takes far too long when the industry leads on this stuff. But the Gambling Commission doesn't have the budget or the ability to commission, which is ironic. It doesn't have the ability to commission its own work, to do its own procurement. So what ends up happening is they'll phone up the BGC or the equivalent, and they'll just say, can you guys get on with a single customer view? Now, what I wanted to demonstrate was that from the punter's perspective and from a gambling harm reduction perspective, that's a bad idea for the industry to be running this. And it should be independent of the industry because of, you know, existing data practices. And the Gambling Commission's, you know, regulations aren't really fit for purpose in terms of having proper oversight and standards of data and how it's used and all that stuff. We know that. But I think that was the crucial thing. It was about the single customer view. And look, I think from across the debate, from the spectrum of the gambling reform debate, I think that it's something that, you know, people who are professional gamblers, people who get restricted, they're all concerned about the single customer view being in the hands of the industry too. So I think this is, you know, it's a view that's shared, and the Gambling Commission once again shown that it's pretty bad judgment call, but then it can't do much else at the moment. So I think that needs to change. It needs to be able to commission its own different projects.
Well, we've been saying for ages that the only way that single customer view can work is as an independent thing. I mean, it just does not make sense in any other way, especially if you factor in the presence of an ombudsman down the line.
Yeah.
Because that single customer view will be reporting directly to said ombudsman and feeding them information where required. You don't need any buffers in between the two, to put it as politely as I possibly can. I've got a really personal question now, Matt.
Sure.
And I understand if you don't want to answer, okay?
Go for it.
This is going back to your lived experience, right? I think every responsible gambling person that we've spoken to, all of them, I think that I know, and all the stuff that I've read, a gambling problem, a gambling addiction, is almost always a symptom of a wider ill. Was yours a part of a package, or was it something that was in isolate? Because, you know, usually or often it's in men, it's possibly substance abuse, very often linked with alcoholism or alcohol abuse. One that I was absolutely stunned to find out, but in problem gamblers with women, domestic abuse is a huge factor. Mm. I had no idea about that, but it makes perfect sense once you say it out loud. Was there a cofactor for you?
There wasn't, as far as I'm aware. I mean, I was quite young when I started, so it's difficult. I mean, I wasn't kind of fully developed and fully grown at that point.
You'd hit puberty.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, you know, your brain develops into your 20s. So like I wasn't fully grown. Was there anything else? I didn't have alcohol or drug problems. I didn't,
There's depression. There's all sorts of, you know, I mean,
yeah, as far as I'm aware, I didn't, I didn't have anything. I mean, there was certainly mental health issues after. Now, whether they were pre-existing before and they were exacerbated by the addiction or they were a causal factor, I think it's difficult to say. Certainly, the mental health problems I had after were much more severe than what I had ever remember having before. So, you know, anxiety and depression and that sort of stuff. So,
maybe for everything we've heard, that's fairly unusual.
Yeah, it may well be. I mean, look, I think the cause of addiction is obviously an interesting question, and there are obviously multiple factors. And one of them is your kind of, I think some people are more predisposed than others with, if they do have, particularly if they do have pre-existing mental health problems, or there are other environmental factors that you've alluded to. But I think certainly the primary cause and driver was the product, like the fixed odds betting terminal, which was, I found to be as addictive as, I smoked in my 20s, more addictive than nicotine. You know, so that was kind of the way that's how I remember it. It was an addictive product that I got addicted to. And yes, there may well have been, my life may not have been perfect, whose is, but there was nothing that really stood out for me as being a causal mental health factor.
Fenton's is. Fenton's life is perfect.
Sorry.
I thought you were talking about my mental health problems. This is why I run ultra marathons at the weekend, John.
Yeah, but you've got your release valve there, haven't you? You got your
little, it took me a while to figure that one out, let's be honest. And I still
Yeah, but you can drink your way through it. Okay, that's very interesting.
So I feel like we've got a bit of a bit of common ground. I think the things I said, it wasn't a huge amount of pushback on the proposals.
No, look, I'd gambling ombudsman makes sense. Stake limits make sense, and I think probably the area we'd haggle over is equalization across all platforms, statutory levy and an independent body to distribute it makes perfect sense. End gambling advertising around football. Perfect sense. And affordability checks, we've been banging that drum for a long time. So
solved.
Let's get Boris on the phone and let's get you in charge.
we can't go. Get Boris on the phone. Do you know why?
He's in Poland. He's sorting out Ukraine. Is he?
They've got phones in Poland. Fucking hell, Matt. Don't be so negative about our European cousins.
My wife to be is actually Polish, so she'll probably
I know somebody is not getting any this week. We won't get Boris on the phone. Well, we might get Boris on the phone, but there's no way I'm ever going to have a conversation with that man without telling him what a massive twat he is. Any American listeners, that's like your twat. Okay.
We like to translate.
Well, we live in a global society, Fenton, and I think the sooner we embrace that, the better, as I was thinking when I put something in the trunk of my car just yesterday.
See, he was so smooth when he did that. He was so smooth. Oh, he's a professional.
I'm like a continuity announcer.
Oh, I just learn so much every week. It's amazing. It's amazing.
I'm so sorry. Fenton, did you want to talk about Gamban?
To be honest with you, I think we should stop on a high. I think Gamban's a great app. Everyone should install it or recommend it on their websites and stuff. So that's a no-brainer. But no, look, I think we've got these five mega points. Matt's been awesome. We've made a new friend. We've learned lots. I think we just high-five each other and call it a day.
But also we could suggest sister brands for Gamban, because I've been thinking about Hamban.
Go on.
Jamban is multifaceted because you've got conserves, preserves, but you've also got musical, like improvisation.
Okay.
And that should be banned, I think, probably. Not like banned generally, if people are good at it, but like in your average pub on a Sunday night, definitely be banned.
But you could also go ban specific, so you could have Wham-Ban.
Yeah. But there will be pushback at this at some point, and somebody will probably launch Ban-Ban. So we need to preempt that and register that domain now.
I'm on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, thank you for mentioning it. Obviously, check out Gamban, blocks access to gambling sites and apps on your devices, and designed to be as difficult to remove as possible, although some operating systems make this easier than others. But it's as good as it can be, we hope. So yeah, please do check that out if you need it.
Fantastic. Sweet. Thanks, Matt.
Matt, thanks for joining us. It's very much appreciated. I appreciate before you came on, you may have thought you were, you know, sticking your face in a fan, getting caught in the gears of a combine. But thank you for answering everything with honesty and openness. We appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thanks, guys. No, really good to chat.
And that's the end of the podcast. Big thank you to all our guests. Big thank you to you, our listeners, for sticking all the way to the end. We've got two special things to ask you to do. One is, please hit subscribe. Two is, please share with any of your colleagues or friends that you think might be interested in the Gambling Files podcast. And three, I know I said two, but I'm always going to sneak one in because I'm always looking for that little bit more. John really wants to buy a bike, so we're looking for a sponsor. If you're a sponsor and you think you'd be fantastic fit for the Gambling Files podcast, we've got great reach, great audience, all the decision makers listen to us. Please get in touch and we will take care of you. Thank you very much.